It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, an elected official from a northern Wisconsin tribe tells us why the Chippewa Tribal Council voted to remove an oil pipeline from tribal land.
First, the federal government recently advised state officials to hold off on any new major road projects in Wisconsin and aim to complete projects currently underway.
The advisory comes at a time when federal funding for state projects could change with a new presidential administration and when state lawmakers haven't reached a consensus for the best way to fund and complete road projects throughout Wisconsin.
Patrick Marley is with us. He's the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering this news. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
What did the Federal Highway Administration specifically tell us here in Wisconsin in its letter?
So it wrote to the Department of Transportation last month. We just found out about it, saying that the state's plans for its roads and the amount of money that it has do not line up, and that it wants a more realistic set of plans from the department, and that it wants it to not begin new major projects until it can wrap up projects that are already underway in a timely fashion.
What stake do the feds have in how we lay out our highway plans here in Wisconsin?
Well, they spend about 25% of the money Wisconsin spends comes from the federal government. So on any project where they are helping fund it, they have a say in what's done, and they ultimately could withhold money for a project if the state doesn't come to an agreement with them on what it's going to do.
As you understand from the letter, I gather they didn't respond to your calls, but from the letter, why were they saying this needed to happen? What were their concerns if the state proceeded as planned?
Well, the state for years has been on a course that many folks watching our budget have known is not very sustainable, and I think that they're concerned about that. It's sort of we're getting to a point where it's getting harder and harder to paper over the challenges in the road fund. And so, you know, we're now, for instance, I-94 north-south in Racine County was supposed to be completed last year. It is now now on track to be completed in 2028. So projects like that start to alarm the feds a great deal, particularly because when you extend the life of a project that long, then you're doing things like having to put a layer of asphalt over the top of a project that is just going to be torn up as you do the actual work of rebuilding it.
And road construction projects, I understand from reading your piece, it's we as drivers see when they start putting up cones, a lot goes into it before the project, environmental statements, a lot of planning, things like that. Is that part of the problem, that we might have a lot of different balls in the air when it comes to these projects and we need to settle in on which ones we're going to actually juggle?
Yes, that's exactly right, especially for these very big projects like, you know, the Marquette Interchange or the Zoo Interchange. There's years of planning that goes into that. Another major project in the Madison area would be the rebuilding of the Beltline south of the city. And so that's a project that the feds say we should put off because with things like the project in Racine County not being able to be completed, why on earth would we do additional planning for the Beltline knowing that it's going to be so far down the pipeline that the plans might not even be relevant by the time we could put shovels in the ground?
Patrick Marley is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Looking at a letter from the Federal Highway Administration suggesting Wisconsin hold off on new major road projects until we get some of the ones in the works actually done. Patrick, what kind of responses have we heard from state lawmakers on this?
Well, I talked to Robin Voss, the Speaker of the Assembly. He's been pushing for more money for roads and some kind of revenue increase. He says this is exactly it's only going to get worse from the perspective of the feds, and that this is a sign that we have to address this problem right away. There is, of course, a big split among Republicans who control state government, with Voss on the one hand looking for more money, Governor Walker on the other hand saying that he's not going to have a gas tax increase unless we make cuts in other taxes elsewhere.
And there's been some response saying, well, this is from a federal government run by Barack Obama. Pretty soon we're going to have a federal government run by Donald Trump. Maybe the story will change there a little bit, especially with this idea of a lot of infrastructure spending coming down the way.
That's the state. statement from the spokesman for Governor Walker. In the short term, it's hard to see what significantly could change. Trump has talked about a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure, but the details have been very sketchy on that. It's unclear how he could get that through Congress. You know, there's not a will to increase the federal gas tax, which hasn't been increased in decades. So if you don't increase the federal gas tax, you'd have a significant deficit spending, which is something Republicans who control Congress don't want to see. So hard to see how that money could come forward. If it doesn't, I don't see how the Trump administration can say much different to Wisconsin. If it doesn't have the money, how can it build its roads?
Looking at the big picture of transportation funding in Wisconsin, I mean, there's the two categories we've talked about, new road projects and then currently planned road projects that have been postponed, aren't underway. On top of that, there's road maintenance, local roads. We've been talking about mostly highways so far. There are a lot of different pieces of this puzzle. And what do you see giving, given that there's not enough money to do all of that?
Well, what the Walker plan that we've seen so far would actually increase the amount of money that goes to local roads. There'd be more of a focus on maintaining what we've got, and then these delays on the bigger projects. That has a cascading effect. You know, every time you delay one large project, you're delaying everything that's scheduled to happen behind it.
Governor Walker, in his State of the State address, suggested there would be more funding for transportation Wisconsin for these roads and highways we're talking about. Has there been any indication of how he's going to pull that off, what he'll reach into to make that happen?
Yeah, what he's really talking about is finding a way. It is repurposing the existing money to give big increases to the local government so that they have more money to take care of their roads. But overall, if you look at the entire plan, they still have about $1 billion shortfall between what the state's plans on the books are for highway projects and the actual money that will be coming in.
This, in our last budget, transportation was the biggest item, I think, ended up being taken out of the budget itself as a separate item at one point. Is this going to be the big debate within the Republican Party this year, do you think?
Yeah, actually, they didn't take it out of the budget last year. What they did is they approved a certain level of bonding and then had this additional bonding that they would have to have a second vote on by their budget committee. So that's what they did. I think that it is going to be even more of a contentious issue this time. You really have this resistance from Assembly Republicans to keeping up with the status quo. Republicans in both houses say they don't want to rely on too much borrowing. Our borrowing is quite high. So that really gives you few options. It's cut projects or raise the gas tax or find some other revenue source, unless there's some third way that they can find to cut income taxes or some other tax and then get an agreement on raising the gas tax. I expect months of fighting over this issue.
You know, this time of year, road maintenance is dropping cold packs into potholes until we can get a warmer weather to do things. But are we at a point where we're not sure what's happening this summer or next summer when it comes to, shovels hitting the road?
I mean, it's not like construction will stop, right? There's going to be you're going to continue to see orange barrels no matter what. What you may see is just a road goes a little longer before the orange barrels go up, or that once the orange barrels go up, they stay up for a longer period of time. Under the plan that's currently being advanced by the Walker administration, you would see the number of roads in poor condition in the state, the number of highways double in about 10 years. So it just means more protracted construction and maybe longer I would say it would just mean more construction in general, because if you try to extend the life of some of these roads, you have to do sort of short-term maintenance, cold patching them or paving them as you wait to do the total resurfacing or reconstruction of a road.
And inside Governor Walker's cabinet, we saw the former transportation secretary announce his resignation. He's out. There's a new one in place. Have we heard the new state transportation secretary speak up on priorities for the governor and for his department?
We have not heard what he's had to say. That's David Ross replacing Mark Gottlieb. I think that one thing that the federal government asked in writing this letter was that the department's top officials meet with them to explain what their plans are and spell this all out. That letter was sent on December 7th, and the federal government said they wanted to meet by the end of January. They had not met as of Friday. I believe that part of the desire there was to get the new team in place and probably up to speed at the top of the State Department of Transportation before they held that meeting.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us for a look at a warning from the federal government to Wisconsin lawmakers to hold off on plans for new road projects in the state pending a solution to the state's transportation funding problems. The Northern Wisconsin tribe has called for the removal of an aging oil pipeline from its land. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa decided not to renew easements with the Canadian energy firm Enbridge.
The Enbridge pipeline, known as Line 5, crosses about 12 miles of tribal lands on its route from Superior to the Straits of Mackinac. Line 5 of the Enbridge pipeline transports about 540,000 barrels of light crude oil and natural gas per day.
Central Time invited an Enbridge representative to join the program. Enbridge said a spokesperson wouldn't be available to join us. They did send us a statement in which they said, quote, Enbridge was not contacted directly by the band. We are surprised to learn of the Bad River Band's decision not to renew individual easements within the reservation for Line 5 after negotiating in good faith for the past several years.
Mike Berlin joins us now. He's the vice chairperson for the Bad River Tribal Council members. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, thank you for having me today.
And Mike, let's start with the reasoning here. Why did the council decide to vote against these easements for Enbridge?
Well, let me just say this. The Bad River Tribal Council, we've had a public hearing with our people here back on December 15th. And we shared with our tribal members that we have four pipelines coming through the Bad River Indian Reservation. And part of that was sharing the current information with regards to Enbridge. Enbridge's name came up a number of times. We were asked if this has to do with Standing Rock, and it has nothing to do with Standing Rock. Standing Rock over there is a pipeline that's being placed in the ground. Pipeline here at number 5 going across 12.2 miles of the Bad River Indian Reservation is already in place.
You said there are four pipelines going through the Bad River Reservation. Are those all parts of that same Pipe 5 from Enbridge?
No, it's not. We have TransCanada coming through here, Northern Natural Gas. Those are propane lines. Enbridge number 5 is the only pipeline that has sweet crude that is pumped through its line.
You said that this did not really have anything to do with the protests elsewhere about oil pipelines, but the reasoning is similar. You want to talk about what the reasoning
it's
was?
It's somewhat similar, but let me just back up just a second here. For as a matter of fact, some of the things that was talked about at our meeting on December 15th was with regards to Enbridge this, Enbridge that, and they tried to tie it together with Standing Rock. And I got upset to the point where I grabbed the hose of the mic and I said, let me ask the question. I says, when has this tribal council sat down with Enbridge? In the last 3 years that I've sat here on the council, we have never yet to have a discussion with Enbridge. As a matter of fact, I pointed to the back of the room on September 18th, I believe it was. We went out to Houston, Texas. We spent the day with TransCanada. We reviewed their operations. It was a whole day session from 8 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And following that, we went over to Pipeline Safety Conference for 2 days. And there I had gotten an education with regards to the 49, the CFR, and different parts 174 on the construction and the maintenance and so on, and a part 179, which covers all the safety aspects of the pipeline. I did get an education on that journey that we had out with those folks.
And Mike, you said you hadn't sat down with Enbridge before. Enbridge said in that statement that they've been negotiating in good faith about this with you for the past several years. So are you saying this just hasn't been in person? So it hasn't been the same educational opportunity that you've had with other organizations?
Let me go there. Okay. Enbridge has been in communication with our staff down in Natural Resources. They have not had, and what I'm saying is that we have not had no direct communication with Enbridge themselves. As a matter of fact, TransCanada has come to one of our council meetings with an entourage of 9 different people, including their attorney. And at one of those, at that particular session, I had requested a, when that line was put in that they were talking about with regards of, I said, obviously you folks have an as-built. I'll give you a little, just a 3-second background. I worked with engineering with the Bureau of Indian Affairs for 28 years, and I'm a retiree of those folks. And I know there's always a set of plans, especially with these pipelines. They know the person who welded each and every weld and so on, what have you. And on this particular pipeline, number 5, when this was put in the early 50s, they didn't have the technology that they had in the 60s when they went out and x-rayed every weld and all that kind of stuff. They did not have that technology back in the 50s. And originally, to my to my direction, the information that I've researched is that that pipeline was given a life of originally 50 years. That pipeline has been in the ground now for well over 63 years, since the early 50s.
1953 is the date I had. So the concern you have is that maybe it's past its shelf life, that there could be some liabilities or some weaknesses in it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, this is a concern that we've had because Enbridge themselves says not long ago they invested $100 million in upgrading the equipment in their line, which at the point in time, they were pushing 490,000 barrels of crude or sweet sand through that line. After the improvements of that $100 million pipe improvement, not the pipe improvement, but the pumping and all the other stuff, they have increased the capacity to 540,000 barrels a day. So they've increased that significantly without doing any upgrades to the pipeline itself, to the pipe that's in the ground. That bothers me.
We're talking with Mike Berlin right now from the Bad River Tribal Council, where he's the vice chairman, talking about a recent vote by that council to remove Enbridge Pipeline from the reservation. And Mike, would the tribe be willing to negotiate with Enbridge about this? Maybe not now, maybe at a later date.
We have a letter from Enbridge dated the 6th of January, requesting a session with the council. I don't believe the council has answered that at this point, but at our next regular meeting, we do have intentions of addressing this. As a matter of fact, we have a session on the with the council itself, and this is going to be a topic of discussion, I'm sure, for perhaps as much as a half a day, because of how we want to address this with Enbridge and what Enbridge has to bring to the table and what our concerns are. Obviously, the water table and all the, if anything was to ever happen, even if it was a minor spill versus a major spill, that would be a major catastrophe here on the Bad River Reservation.
Enbridge is associated with the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history. This is the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill. Do you see this move by your tribe as being part of a bigger conversation about oil pipelines going through reservations?
I'm sure of it. I'm sure that will be part of the topic of discussion.
And what have you heard from Enbridge so far? We read a little bit of that statement, and more of it is posted online, but what do you think about how they've communicated so far?
Well, Enbridge, according to the January 6th letter, Enbridge has indicated that they've been working with these 15 allottees on these parcels of property in question. And since 2013 to the present date, they have not communicated, at least not to my knowledge, that any of the courtesy copies that they would normally send to the other, agencies or, you know, like, say, for instance, the Battle Road Tribe. We've not been kept in the loop with regards to those transactions. And they further closed the letter out. They respectfully request a meeting with the tribal council members for the purpose of discussing mutual concerns and interest in this matter. Well, I can obviously see their point. We're both in the business. They're in the business of making money. And I understand they own the pipeline. They don't own the product that they ship through that pipeline. They ship that for customers. And, of course, the Battle River Tribal Council, we are a government business. We're here to take care of the people that live within the boundaries of the reservation. And we need to protect that.
Now, the tribe did grant those easements for the pipeline. Granted, it was a while ago. It was in 1953. But has the motivation changed on that decision?
So let me bring you up to date just a little bit. 1953 was the original easement that was approved. There was another easement that was approved here more recently here in 1992, and that finally became in 1995. And what had happened, to my understanding, is the Bureau of Indian Affairs had approved. Let me back up a second. When the Tribal Council has approved this easement actually in 1995, that was for another 50 years to take us to 2040. Okay? Now, at this point in time, there's these 15 key individuals out there that have allotted lands. My understanding that the Bureau of Indian Affairs had signed off for these 15 individuals a 20-year easement with Enbridge. So that 20-year easement expired here in 2013.
And we leave it there. Mike Berlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mike Berlin, Vice Chairman of the Bad River Tribal Council. He joined us to talk about a vote to remove an oil pipeline from a northern Wisconsin reservation.
The inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump is just days away. Trump will be inheriting a country that has a deep partisan divide, as this close and divisive election showed.
A new mini-series from Frontline looks back at events during Barack Obama's presidency that revealed deep divisions in the United States and examines what kind of a country Trump will inherit. The two-night documentary miniseries called Divided States of America premieres tonight on Wisconsin Public Television at 8 p.m. A second part will air tomorrow night at the same time.
Mike Weiser joins us now to talk about the miniseries he's producer and writer for Frontline on PBS, and he's one of the producers and writers of the new documentary Divided States of America. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, as you often do on Frontline, you're kind of at this point where news is starting to turn into history. Looking back, did it strike you how pivotal some of these moments were that we might not have known at the time?
You know, well, this is really a film that we've been making throughout Obama's presidency, but we really started making it in the last year. About this time last year, we started putting together what we call the boxes, the key events throughout Obama's time, and trying to understand what were the key moments in Obama's presidency. And as the election went on, and as Donald Trump captured the nomination of his party and eventually the presidency, we really started to see a lot of resonance and it really brought out how important some of the key events were in Obama's presidency to the moment that we're in right now.
Yeah, we've ended up with, whether people are happy about it or not, really the anti-Obama, the opposite of President Obama in many ways, with President-elect Donald Trump. And you can see, looking back at your documentary, the steps toward that and sort of this anti-establishment fervor that was starting really even before President Obama was elected.
That's right. Our film really begins in the 2008 campaign, and one of the key moments is the decision by John McCain to choose Sarah Palin to be his running mate, a governor of Alaska who he didn't know too much about other than that she seemed to be a maverick like him. But what the people we spoke to, including a number of senior officials in the Republican Party, told us was that it really signaled a moment of the rise of a populist conservatism that had not been central to the Republican Party up until that point, but would only grow. It would be fueled by the opposition to President Bush's bailout of Wall Street, and it would continue to grow through the Tea Party and throughout Barack Obama's presidency.
Right. The story here, as I look back at Divided America, is it's not just Republican versus Democrat. It's establishment and anti-establishment, and maybe bad luck for the Democrats. They came into this election with a very establishment candidate, and the Republicans came in with a very anti-establishment candidate.
That's right. And that's been the current, even before Obama came in. Obama came in to office on a promise that he was going to change Washington. And Donald Trump also comes into office on a promise that he's going to shake things up and to change Washington. But what we saw over those 8 years was a real fundamental distrust of the establishment. And it was and of the elites, as Sarah Palin termed them when she first got the nomination. And what you really saw, especially strong, this movement was inside the Republican Party, was a feeling among the grassroots of the Republican Party that the Republican Party leadership, the Republican Party establishment, had let them down. And a number of voters were looking for a change, looking for somebody who would come from outside the system to change things.
Well, let's look back at President Obama. A couple clips here from the documentary, one from the president's campaign in 2008, the second in 2012. Let's give a listen.
We have never been just a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America. If I said the sky was blue, they said no. If I said there were fish in the sea, they said no. They figured if Obama fails, then we win.
So initially, at least a message of hope that people could reach across the partisan divide. And you hear clips in the documentary from people like John Boehner as well, hoping that these things could happen. And then everybody kind of runs into this wall of division and partisanship. And watching different moments, you see opportunities maybe missed and squandered by the president and by his Republican counterparts in Congress.
That's right. There were numerous opportunities throughout Obama's presidency where people said, this looks like the moment, maybe finally on this issue, they're going to be able to achieve bipartisanship. Maybe they'll finally be able to do something about the budget. Maybe they'll finally be able to do something about background checks for guns. And each time it falls apart. But one of the amazing things looking back on Obama's presidency was just how early on the partisanship was clear to both Republicans and to Democrats. He came in after this amazing inauguration of the country's first black president and a surge in optimism around the country about what he might be able to accomplish. But in his very first week facing economic downturn and a financial crisis, he tries to push through a stimulus bill. And in that first week, the two sides, the Republicans, the minority in the House and the White House, aren't able to come together to pass a bipartisan bill. And we spoke to senior leaders in the White House, like David Axelrod and Minority Leader Eric Cantor at the time, and they both told us that early on, that even in those first few weeks, they had come to a conclusion that they weren't going to be able to work with the other side. And that's a pretty amazing thing, that it was that early on in Obama's presidency.
Talking to Mike Weiser from Frontline about their new documentary, Divided States of America, from the election of President Obama to the election of Donald Trump. Obamacare, the big story for most of President Obama's terms as president, and still, you know, new chapters happening now. This was the thing that seemed to really cement this division, and each side has their own narrative. Republicans say, hey, they rammed this thing through, partisan, not a single Republican vote. Democrats say, we tried to compromise. Republicans wouldn't go there. They intentionally tried to make it a partisan issue. What made this health care plan so divisive?
Well, it really was the key to defining what Obama's presidency would be like. It was his signature domestic policy achievement in his first year. It took up it ate up the entire first year of Obama's presidency. They go into it believing that they can win over Republicans and trying to craft a bill in the Senate that would at least win over moderate Republicans. But in the midst of the health care bill, something happened that I think neither side really expected, which was a tremendous backlash in the form of the Tea Party. And it begins over the summer of 2009 as Obamacare is being talked about. Suddenly there's talk of death panels. There's talk about the government, a government takeover of health care. And suddenly on the Republican Party, even moderates who had been talking to Obama realized that if they wanted to survive, this wasn't something that they were going to be able to go along with. And so the two sides in that first year really throw down the gauntlet over Obamacare. And the Republicans come back into the 2010 midterms and promise to repeal Obamacare, something we're hearing a lot of talk about now. I think one of the things that may have gotten missed in all of this was the extent to which Obamacare also shook up the Republican Party. A lot of people we talked to said it was the Republicans' promise to their voters in 2010 that they, if they were elected to Congress, that they would repeal Obamacare. And it was their failure to do that, since they didn't have the presidency and at the time the Senate, to do that, that really fueled anger at the Republican establishment and a belief that they weren't representing their voters. So it had a tremendous effect both on Obama and his presidency, but also on the Republican Party itself.
And you follow Republicans trying to harness this Tea Party wave. They did so very successfully in 2010, nowhere more so than here in Wisconsin, actually. But then it started to eat Republicans, too. You talk to Eric Cantor a lot. He got overthrown by a challenge from the right. There are probably 12 or 13 would-be presidents on the Republican side who would view themselves as victims of this wave, as Donald Trump ended up taking that nomination. This was something that they couldn't quite control in the way they thought they could, was it?
That's right. I think Eric Cantor's story is especially informative for understanding what went on inside the Republican Party. He was part of a group that called themselves the Young Guns, that went out in 2010 looking for candidates who would speak to the desires of the Tea Party and speak the language of the Tea Party. And he rode in to become majority leader on that election. But as the new members came to Washington, it turned out that they were not the same as previous generations of freshman congressmen, that they came to Washington really determined to change things, not to stay there, not to work their way up through the system. And Eric Cantor found that himself with a caucus that neither he nor Speaker John Boehner could control, and found himself with a base of voters who were frustrated with him, who saw anything that looked like the traditional Washington deal making as something that was bad. And Eric Cantor, who for many Democrats was the symbol of opposition to Obama, for many Republicans was the symbol of compromise and the old way of doing things. And he found himself losing in his own primary, which really sent a shockwave through the Republican Party and through the Congress.
We're talking to Mike Weiser from Frontline about the new documentary miniseries Divided States of America.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's accurate to characterize the nation today as the divided states of America? What do you think is behind that division? Why do you think we're in a time of such hyper-partisanship? And do you see this partisanship in your own everyday life? What do you think can help unite politicians and help them work across the aisle? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with Mike Weiser, producer and writer for Frontline on PBS and part of the team behind Frontline's new documentary miniseries, Divided States of America.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Do you see us as the divided states of America these days? Do you want to see politicians, maybe on your side, reaching across the aisle, compromising, or being uncompromising, sticking by their guns, ideologically sound. Do you worry about what this all could do to the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page, The Divided States of America looks back at the last 8 years in American national politics. Mike, a subplot that turned out to be a really big one was you follow Donald Trump, his response, his participation in the birther movement, his promotion of that. And soon after Mitt Romney lost the election 4 years ago, he registered this trademark, something called Make America Great Again.
That's right. Donald Trump really stepped into the divisions inside the Republican Party and saw a real opportunity. First, he made a name for himself as a birther, as somebody questioning Barack Obama's birth certificate. And in doing that, he was speaking to part of the Republican Party that was very distrustful of the president and believed in the conspiracy theory that perhaps the president was not even an American, something that other establishment Republicans were not willing to do. And With that credibility that he had, he was even at one point leading in the polls for the 2012 election. He ends up endorsing Mitt Romney, and Mitt Romney in Las Vegas goes to a Trump hotel to receive Donald Trump's endorsement. And it really brings him into the Republican Party leadership. When Mitt Romney loses, Donald Trump takes to Twitter to complain about that loss, but it's only a few days later that he registers that trademark, Make America Great Again. We spoke to his longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, who says that around this time he talked to Trump and Trump was handicapping the race, and that he was sure, even back then, that Trump was serious about running in 2016.
Let's talk about the state of division in America. You talked to some of, some journalists and others about this. There are people listening right now who cannot intellectually or emotionally understand how someone could vote for the candidate of the other party, whichever party they're in. It's almost like two alien groups not understanding each other at all. Is that what we're seeing in American politics these days?
That's right. There were a lot of voters this time around, especially supporters of Hillary Clinton, who were really in shock that Donald Trump had won the election. One of the scenes we have in the film is how the same thing happened 4 years mm-hmm. before. How when Barack Obama was reelected, there was a real disbelief amongst a number of Republicans. And one of the reasons for that, the journalist Molly Ball says in the film, is that people now tend to live around people who think like they do. They tend to consume news from that aligns with the way that they see the world and with the way that they think. And so it becomes increasingly difficult to understand how somebody on the other side, how somebody who supports the other candidate could do that. So if you live in a certain pocket where the politics goes one way, it can be extremely difficult to understand how people on the other side hold the views that they do. And it really goes to the heart of the problem that the country faces.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hi, hello. And I agree that, yes, we are a divided country. And I didn't hear your last comments, but I think we're divided for a lot of reasons that are not spoken of on radio, the pundits and the newspapers is briefly, but I think the reason why we finally got the president-elect that we had is because so many moral things have been destroyed in this country, and it finally became a straw that broke the camel's back. And for instance, first of all, many years ago, the Supreme Court decision that it was okay for women and men to kill their babies in the form of legal abortion. And then the latest one, of course, is the fact that Mr. Obama completely destroyed marriage and the views of marriage that have been true for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Richard, I gotcha. And Mike, he's coming from a perspective on those social issues. How did you see social issues like abortion, same-sex marriage playing out in this growing divide? A lot of the story has been economic and over things like healthcare, but that's not the whole story.
No, it's not the whole story. And obviously there's divisions over politics, there's divisions over the approach to religion, over social policy, and I think what you've seen over the time, over the last 8 years while Barack Obama's been in office, is that a lot of those divisions have, if not been revealed, have gotten deeper.
Richard, thanks.
But yes, they are definitely there.
Richard, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mike Weiser is with us from Frontline. Their new documentary is Divided States of America. You can check that out on Wisconsin Public Television starting tonight. Back to our callers. Jake is with us in South Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Jake?
I wanted to... The question I heard when I got on the radio was, why do I think America is divided? And I don't think I'm old enough to have a full view, but I can give a point of view from my generation, I believe. I'm 32 years old, and I understand I am the crest of the millennial wave, where from a very early age we were advertised that we deserve more and we should be getting more from everything. And the economy of the 90s was able to deliver on that. But with an economic downturn and the advent of social media, the building frustrations of adulthood and a downturn economy and the anonymity of social media has led to a group of people who are less and less socially inclined to talk to each other, more and more frustrated, and they feel they can get away with saying whatever they feel like.
Interesting, Jake. Thanks a lot. Mike, a lot there. Where do you want to run with that?
Well, yeah, definitely the economy, which was cratering as Barack Obama came into office, does play a key role and really fueled anger on both sides. He inherited and continued a bailout of Wall Street that angered many on the right, which saw it as big government assisting business, and many on the left who believed that this was an example of Wall Street being favored over Main Street. So for both Democrats, I think you can see in the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, and for many Republicans, there was a real feeling that they were being left behind, that elites, that the establishment, that Wall Street, that powerful special interests were the ones benefiting. And I think that is important to understanding what was going on in exacerbating this divide on both sides.
Let's bring on one more caller. Bob is with us in Mercer. Bob, hi. Briefly, please.
Hi. Just calling to say, I think a lot of this stuff, I mean, if I were to put it in a little nutshell, I would say it's the year of frustration. A lot of what's happening in our cities with regard to, you know, the Justice Department investigating police departments over, you know, force against the black community. There's, you know, there's the conservative party who felt they haven't been heard. There's the workers out there who labor every day and felt they haven't been served. I think this is all a huge revolt voice. But on the other hand, I will have to say it's been a divisive presidency. I mean, this is a man who investigated through his IRS hundreds of conservative organizations and nonprofits that he didn't do a single one on the Democratic side. He passed a health care bill on Christmas Eve that didn't include one Republican vote.
And Bob, just a quick response from Mike. The year of frustration, especially from people unhappy with the presidency of Barack Obama, culminating in Inauguration Day of Donald Trump in just a few days, 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see a lot of things inside his presidency that he didn't realize would be so divisive. And certainly one of the ones we talk about in the film is the issue of race and of policing, which he runs into in that very first summer in 2009 when he wades into the Henry Louis Gates arrest and really provokes a strong backlash that he was not expecting.
We'll leave it there, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. having me.
That's Mike Weiser. He's a producer and writer for Frontline on PBS, and he's one of the producers and writers of the new documentary miniseries. It's called Divided States of America. It premieres tonight and continues tomorrow night on public television. That's airing, I believe, at 8 p.m. Both nights. You can check it out tonight. Look for your local listings. And you can still share your thoughts, by the way, over on the Central Time Facebook page. A shark in Australia is making news for doing something that seems a little impossible, giving birth to baby sharks. Well, that part's normal. But what's weird is that this shark named Leone hasn't shared a tank with a male shark for 3 years.
But hold on. Scientists say it's not quite as crazy as it sounds. A lot of invertebrates can give birth in an asexual way, but for vertebrates like sharks, it seems to be extremely rare.
And these shark babies aren't clones either, though they do have less genetic variation than a two-parent shark would.
And the word of the day from this shark story, parthenogenesis. Parthenogenesis, that's the word for what this zebra shark did. And
mom, no dad.
Also your next Scrabble word, maybe.
Now, that's going to be hard to pull off on the Scrabble board or Words with Friends for those who play that, because you only got 7 letters at a time.
It's got a lot of letters.
You're going to need these puppies to line up just right to get parthenogenesis. So I guess good news for sharks? I don't know.
Seems like good. And this was an endangered species of shark, so definitely good for the zebra shark species. So there's a silver lining. I don't see anybody talking about it translating to humans anytime in the near future.
Well, who knows what technology in the future may hold. This is Central Time with all your latest shark news here on the Ideas Network.